This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. In this hour, we are tracking results. Astronaut Scott Kelly became a human test subject. Spending a year in space, he will tell you the results of that. Also, what resulted when 100,000 Atlantic salmon spilled into Puget Sound? And what's the result of the University of Washington acting to protect undocumented students? First off, outer space smells like a sparkler on the 4th of July. Slightly burned, slightly metallic, so says my next guest, and he ought to know. Retired astronaut Scott Kelly was on 4 space flights, including an entire year aboard the International Space Station. He's written the new memoir called Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery, and he's in our studio. Scott Kelly, welcome to KUOW.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Why does space smell like burned metal?
I don't know. It just does.
I mean, I understand there's probably hot metal in planets and stuff, but you're so far from anything, I don't get it.
Well, I think it's the smell of the stuff that was exposed to space. It's really not the smell of nothing, right? Nothing have a smell.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the outside of the space station that was at vacuum or, you know, exposed to the harsh rays of the sun as a particular smell.
So it smells like metal if you're in metal.
Sure.
You've said that the typical astronaut memoir focuses on the good stuff and not the things the astronaut might not be proud of. How do you want us to see space travel? And will you tell us stuff you're not proud of?
Well, that's why in my book there are some things that you maybe other people have not written in their memoirs because it's not necessarily a positive thing. But I think it's important to tell the whole story, and I wanted to have my story be believable. And I think when you include things that you're not particularly proud of or, you know, stuff that you're not necessarily comfortable talking about, it makes a more believable story.
What would that be?
Well, in my case, a lot of things. I was a bad student growing up as a kid. I couldn't pay attention. I had, you know, parents that didn't get along and argued, and, you know, father was an alcoholic. I had prostate cancer. I mean, these are things that I think some people might choose not to share, personal things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Well, prostate cancer, I think most of us would imagine that only the super fit are going into space, especially for long periods of time. How did prostate cancer play into that, if at all?
Well, it certainly didn't help me go to space for a long period of time. I wasn't selected because I had cancer, but it's something that happened to me and it happens to other people. And I was able to, you know, work through it, and with some good medical care and support by my employer, NASA, I was able to continue my job. And I think it's a great lesson that, bad things can happen to people. And, you know, if you certainly in my case, there was, I was lucky in some respect that it wasn't as bad as it might have been if I would have caught it later. But with some good medical treatment and, an optimistic outlook, you can, you know, continue do the things that you want to do. And in my case, you know, I flew in space for 20 days in my first two flights, had prostate cancer, and then flew in space for 500 days after. And, I think that's a good
message. What they call a good outcome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. You spent 340 days on the International Space Station, the longest any American has ever spent in free fall around our planet. What does that mean?
Yeah, when we're in space, we are going really fast, and we are, affected by Earth's gravity. Earth's gravity allows us to be in what's called free fall, or this ballistic falling trajectory around Earth, and that's why we float in space. We don't float in space because we're away from the Earth. You know, we're almost as affected by the mass and gravity of the Earth as if you're on the planet. It's just a fact that we're going really, really fast, and we're falling around the Earth, and the space station is as well, so everything floats.
You know what? I can't believe I didn't know that.
I can't believe you didn't know it either.
Yeah, yeah, you should be shocked. I thought of it as being far from Earth's gravity. So when you're floating for that reason, does it feel like zero gravity?
Yes.
Yeah.
It feels like you're falling.
Yeah. What's that like to fall for a year?
It takes a little getting used to. But, you know, it doesn't. I say that it feels like you're falling. It feels like really, it really mostly feels like you're floating. You can make it feel like when I was going to sleep, I could close my eyes and maybe give myself a little bit of a force and velocity in one direction. And I could imagine that I was just falling around the planet, and I could let my mind feel that way for, you know, as long as I wanted, 10, 20 minutes. Some people have reported that on their whole mission on a space shuttle flight that's shorter, they felt like they were falling the whole time, which can be a little bit, you know, probably a little bit of a distraction.
A little bit. But it sounds kind of womb-like, too, to me, to be... There's some freedom to that.
You know, there is. It's fun, certainly. Floating around is fun. There's no question. But at the same time, it makes most things harder to do because you can't put anything down. Everything has to be secured or you'll lose things or stuff will be flying all over the place. It'll be chaos.
Yeah, so you're always having to plan and be efficient and think ahead. Just the mind's got to be edgy all the time.
I don't know if edgy is the right word, but definitely you have to consider efficiency in what you're doing because things are much more complicated to do in zero gravity, with few exceptions. I mean, it does help in a couple areas. One is moving objects that are really heavy because they now no longer have weight. They have mass.
So the workout, I mean, like you could really lift.
That's a different subject, but so moving things around that are very, you know, very large, very heavy objects, it's easier to do. And then just kind of getting yourself into positions you might need to get your body in to access certain areas. Let's say you were fixing something. Imagine, you know, when you try to, you know, connect the coax cable on the back of your TV, how can be awkward.
It's awkward, yeah.
But if you could flip upside down or get in any position you want, it's less awkward. And that's what those two things are easier by being in zero gravity. Everything else, much harder.
Only a couple advantages. In fact, pooping, harder to do. I learned from your book.
What did you say?
Pooping.
Ah, okay.
Right? You wrote about
it. I said, everything is harder to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, why is that?
I'm just shocked that you used that word in that way.
Really?
Yeah, it's like...
I could have used another word.
It's like you turned into an adolescent boy in one moment.
What do astronauts call it? Evacuation?
We don't.
That has a different meaning.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it's more difficult.
Okay. So NASA wanted you up there that long to study what it did to you? Is that about it?
Yeah, so the idea behind Misha, my Russian colleague, and I being in space for almost a year is that we, you know, if we're going to go to Mars someday, which I think we will, I hope we do, we're going to have to understand how the environment affects our human physiology when we're in space for longer periods of time. So that was the premise behind doing this.
And what did it do to you?
Interestingly enough, it had some definitely more negative effects, symptoms than I experienced in my previous flight of 159 days. You know, you lose bone mass and muscle mass, but, you know, those are things you don't necessarily feel. The stuff I felt was, you know, soreness, stiffness, swelling in my legs when I would stand up. My skin reacted to touching anything because I hadn't touched anything for a really long time. So I had like hives and rashes. I had flu-like symptoms. I was nauseous for a while. But that's why we're going to space. We want to learn these things. So when we go to Mars someday, the people that get there are prepared to live and work on the surface of the planet.
Was any of that a surprise? Was that did NASA learn from that? Whoa, you're up to space a year.
I hope so. It was a surprise to me. I think it was a surprise to them as well. And, you know, we need to, you know, learn more about this. I think we're very capable of going to Mars. I think it's more of a political decision than it is a scientific or, you know, engineering problem.
Now, of course, we all get nauseous at some point in the space of a year, or a lot of us do. We get sick and things happen. But you had a unique control group for going into space. You have a twin brother.
Yeah.
Was that a coincidence? How did all that unfold?
It was kind of a sort of a serendipitous thing, because I had been assigned to this mission to be the astronaut that was going to spend a year in space. And then I just happened to ask a question in a briefing when I was kind of getting educated on the science program we had prior to talking to the press about the flight. And I just happened to ask a question, hey, do you guys plan on doing anything with my brother and I, you know, any kind of genetic testing? You know, because he's, you know, we're identical twins, and he worked for NASA for 15 years, and NASA has a lot of baseline data on him going back to 1995 when we first interviewed. So I thought, you know, maybe this was a good idea for an experiment opportunity. And the person I asked the question of, the lead scientist at the Johnson Space Center, said, well, we don't have any plans to do that, but if we did, would you be interested? And I said, yeah, if it made sense, sure. And he said, okay. And then...
baseline meaning someone to compare your experience.
Yeah, my brother.
He's got your DNA.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason I think it had never come up before is apparently it's against the law for the U.S. government to ask their employees to participate in genetic research. You're not even allowed to ask.
Hmm.
And the fact that I had brought it up kind of opened up the door to this as a possibility. So the scientist goes back, the head scientist goes back, talks to his colleagues. They talk to a bunch of researchers, and in fact, there was a lot of interest in doing this, even though it was a a very small sample group of one.
Mm-hmm.
But there was still a lot of interest in doing this as a comparative study with my brother and I, mostly in the area of genetics.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what you learned yet?
Yeah, we've learned some things. As an example, my telomeres. You know what telomeres are? They're these...
Vaguely from biology class, yeah.
Yeah, so these are the things on the ends of our chromosomes, the length of which are an indicator of our physical age. As we age, they get shorter, more frayed. So the hypothesis was I would be in space for a year, harsh environment, floating around, radiation, stress, what have you. And my telomeres would shorten and go in the direction of me getting older compared to my brother. The reality of it is, and what we found was, it was the opposite. They actually got better compared to his. Once I got back on Earth, they kind of caught up to him again.
Really?
And, which is kind of an interesting experiment when you expect one thing to happen and it's the exact opposite. Now, I don't think this is going to be a fountain of youth, but it is, definitely an area that we need to dig deeper into.
Yeah, it's not a big enough data set, but it's intriguing that you didn't age in that way. So the problems of the swelling, the nausea you experienced, does all that seem fixable for space travel? Any red flags from the year-long experiment?
Well, I think going to Mars, I think we're fine. The physical challenge of going to Mars is protecting the crew from radiation. You know, as we get away from the magnetic field of the Earth, the crew is exposed to more radiation than we are currently on the International Space Station. And I think that's the big physical challenge, is the radiation exposure. Because a trip to Mars will take 200 days. You know, I spent 340 days in space. You'll be on the surface of Mars for a year with Martian gravity. I think that will help our, physical symptoms. It will help us, staying in shape for the 200-day trip home. And once you get home, if the crew is deconditioned, at least you have support here back on Earth. I think trying to mitigate the effects I experience is more applicable to a mission that would have us in space for a year continuously or longer. So maybe, far in the future when we, go to places that are not Mars, we'll probably have to do it with artificial gravity, I think.
I'm talking with retired astronaut Scott Kelly, author of the new memoir called Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. And we've talked about some physical effects. What about what a year in space did to you mentally, psychically?
Astronauts that have been in space for periods of time, I think probably the longer you've had this privileged experience and view, the more you're affected in this way, I would think. But when you look out at the Earth from space, you see this incredibly beautiful planet. Now, certainly parts of it are covered in pollution all the time, and that's something we need to fix. But
you can see pollution from space?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Certain parts of Asia all the time, almost always covered in pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you know, it makes you, I think, more of an environmentalist. That you look at this beautiful place, and it makes you want to take care of it more. But then you also have this perspective on humanity from looking out at Earth. You know, you see a planet with no political borders, especially during the day. It looks like, you know, we are all people of, you know, continents or people of the entire planet versus from any particular country. When we would follow the news on board the space station, you know, coming from this very beautiful place, it's almost always bad news. Kind of gives you a sense of, you know, I think it puts you more in touch with humanity, maybe a different sense of empathy for, you know, the people of Earth and the problems we all share. And makes you think, you know, maybe we need to work a little bit better to solve those problems, because we all are all in this experience of life on this planet together.
I've heard that from astronauts before, people who see Earth with that view, and that might be more and more of us eventually space traveling, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we are on possibly the cusp of a revolution in space travel, like we were in the early parts of the last century with aviation.
Well, today's aviators, space explorers, it's less NASA and more Jeff Bezos-type billionaires. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's great that we have people like Jeff Bezos that feels so passionately about this, that he's willing to invest $1 billion of his own money every year to fund a space program that at some point will make access to space more affordable than it currently is today. And NASA actually even has partnerships with some countries companies like SpaceX and Boeing to take over access to low Earth orbit because, you know, we hope they can do it cheaper. Hopefully it won't be any less safe, and that's something, you know, we're going to have to demonstrate. And then that allows NASA to use any money saved for, you know, exploration beyond low Earth orbit, and also, you know, frees up our resources to focus on that problem, which is, you know, more complicated than, you know, just going into orbit around our planet.
With space becoming more privatized, do you have any concerns about whether we're doing the right things and the wise things versus the profitable and the marketable things?
Well, I think the privatization and the marketability of that will be decided by the companies, you know, whether what they're doing is makes sense from a business case.
Exactly.
Yeah. So NASA doesn't have that issue. But I do think that the potential exists there to, you know, lower the cost of spaceflight and improve access. So, you know, like we were talking about earlier, we can have more and more people share this incredible experience and this orbital perspective on Earth.
I did learn a few tidbits about going to the International Space Station. There's a few rituals involved. Why do astronauts and cosmonauts wipe down their whole body with alcohol? Because you're gonna replace those germs, right?
Yeah,
what's that about?
Yeah, so actually, we don't wipe down our whole bodies. A Russian doctor.
Just the Russians.
No, the Russian doctor wipes down our whole bodies.
Okay.
You know, it's, you know, there's a lot of tradition in space and, you know, some of the, you know, medical stuff that perspective on medicine and those kind of things. I think the Russians have they're a little bit different than us. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess they've always been wiping down people's bodies with alcohol and no one's died. So I guess you keep doing it.
Keep doing it. Right. At sort of like peeing on the tire of the bus.
Yep. It you know, if it worked,
takes you to the ship.
If it worked for Yuri Gagarin, it's you know, it's going to work for everyone else.
Right. As we were saying, maybe more of us will be space travelers, space tourists, or colonizers of another place. Are there lessons you learned that you want the rest of us to come away with as we head into our space future?
I learned a lot on in my year in space in the course of my career at NASA, including my, you know, my other missions. You know, I learned a lot about Earth and the environment, and I think we need to take care of it better than we do. I think, you know, I learned to be a more empathetic person to the human condition. I learned a lot about, you know, how diversity is very important. You know, this is an international partnership. People with different backgrounds, different, you know, come from different educational backgrounds, different personal experiences, different cultures. And I've definitely noticed that that is a, you know, critically important to having a team that can solve problems in many, many, many different ways. So clearly been demonstrated to me, diverse teams are stronger teams. I learned a lot about leadership. I think leadership is very situationally dependent. But the most important thing I've learned, and that is, you know, we built this space station, 1 million pounds, while flying around the Earth at impossible speeds. It's the most complicated thing we have ever done. And if we can do this, we can do anything, you know, if we put our minds to it. You know, if we want to go to Mars, we can do that. Cure cancer. If we put the resources behind it, we can do that. Solve our issues in this country, which I believe there are many. You know, absolutely inspired after spending a year in space that if we can dream it, we can do it.
Scott Kelly, author of his new memoir called Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery, and you thought to make a kid's version of your memoir, I understand.
Yeah, there's a kid's book for little kids, like 6 to 8 year olds, because the Endurance book is, you know, not for the little ones.
Yes. Scott Kelly, thanks again for this.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. The University of Washington is facing a test of what it means to be a so-called sanctuary campus. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has detained one UW student. He appears to be the first detainee that the university knows of. Now, the UW is wrestling with what it means to offer sanctuary to undocumented students. And here to discuss is KUOW race and equity reporter Liz Jones. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
What happened with this student?
The student was arrested by ICE in September, and has been in custody there in Tacoma, the detention center, since then. His wife, when he was arrested, immediately reached out to UW faculty for help. He was close to some of his professors there. She called, emailed, asked them, what can you do to help my husband? So a little backstory on this student. His name is Bengali Fatih. He is from the Gambia, which is very uncommon to have detainees from the Gambia. Most are from Mexico and Central America. But he came to the U.S. 15 years ago on a student visa. His funding for his school almost immediately fell through. He spent time homeless. He was at one point in what appears to be forced labor. And he did have a criminal record at some point along this way. In 2011, he was convicted of transporting marijuana in Oklahoma. So what has happened with his case with ICE is the Gambia has refused to take back deportees for many years. So he was ordered deported in 2013, but he was released back into the community kind of on supervision. He had to check in with ICE periodically because the Gambia would not take him back. What appears to have happened now is that that policy has changed and he is able to travel back to the Gambia, which is probably why he was arrested.
And what has the University of Washington done so far?
Well, the professors got involved from the start, but kept it really low profile. They weren't sure if publicity would hurt his case. But just over this past weekend, they launched a petition to the UW community asking for support for Bengali Fatih, asking for support to get him released. More than 4,000 people have signed that in just a couple of days. Students are organizing various events. Professors are on campus telling their students about this young man's case. What Perhaps his most significant is a UW law clinic has stepped in to represent him. An attorney there and law students have taken up his case, and they've been able to put his deportation on hold for now because they've discovered he may be eligible for a special type of visa because of the labor trafficking. And here's what his wife, Rebecca, has to say about the help from the UW so far.
I don't know where we would be without the UW right now. I think he would already be deported and back in the Gambia if it weren't for University of Washington stepping up in the way that they have. I hope other universities can emulate what they've done for us.
And what does this mean for the UW's sanctuary policies?
Yeah, well, this really became a big conversation on the UW campus last year after President Trump was elected. There was a letter that was sent from the UW president and the provost reiterating policies that we will not ask about someone's immigration status. And they said that in the future, they'll try to mitigate any negative impacts for undocumented students on campus or find resources for them. So this is sparking more conversation of how do those words look like? What do those words look like in action? What are the logistics of that? Professor Angelina Godoy, she was one of Bengali Fati's professors last year. She's really spearheaded this effort to provide help for him on campus. And she said it's really intended to send a clear message of what is available, what people can do, how you can get involved when a situation like this happens. And here's what she said has kind of been somewhat troubling as she's been thinking about this case.
There must have been others who, you know, stopped coming to class one day and nobody ever knew why. And in a way, that's what disturbs me the most and makes me want to make sure that we don't continue to tolerate this sort of silent siphoning off of our students from our campus. I don't want to be part of a community that doesn't perceive that loss and that doesn't react to it and that doesn't defend its own members.
And Liz, what is at stake here? First of all, for the student.
Well, for the student, for Bengali Fati, he does face deportation if this visa for him does not come through. So he could be sent back. He's already had to leave school. He's got a four-month-old newborn daughter at home with his wife. So his wife has had to go back, leave maternity leave early to go back to nursing at Harborview. She's given up their apartment that they shared together to move in with her sister. So a lot at stake for this family.
And what about for the University of Washington? What are the stakes for them?
Well, they're really kind of walking a line of what it means to be sanctuary. And this is a hot issue in our country right now. Cities are coming under attack for so-called sanctuary policies that might be not in line with what the federal authorities want them to do. So this is coming under question. Federal money has been at stake. So the university has been somewhat quiet as an administration on this issue. You see the resources coming more from individuals on campus, from the law clinic, from professors, from people that are not per se the administration. Dan Sherote was going to be Bengali Fati's professor this quarter. Bengali had to drop out because he was in detention. He actually bought the books. He contacted the professor, tried to figure out, can I do independent study from detention? But he could not get enough computer time there to make it work. But here's what this professor, Dan Sherote, had to say about the kind of delicate situation that the university is in right now.
But I understand that the university is in a somewhat delicate position. It is a state institution. I'm sure people in the administration, I know they're very well aware of this. And they're being careful, and they have to watch what they're legally allowed to do. We're not supposed, we can as individuals participate in politics, express our opinions, join parties, campaign, but we're not supposed to use university facilities for that. They're state facilities. So the university as a whole is supposed to be neutral, but it has to protect itself as well.
So just saying there, you know, this is a political issue, so there's some sensitivity there.
And what happens next on all this, Liz?
Bengali Fati has a bond hearing later this month in Tacoma. A lot of UW students, I understand, are planning to be there. They're planning to do teach-ins for him. So at that hearing, the judge could decide to release him while the rest of his case is pending. And they'll have to wait to see if this, what's called a T visa, comes through because of the labor trafficking. That could take up to 6 months for a decision on that.
That's KUOW's race and equity reporter Liz Jones telling you about the University of Washington facing a test of what it means to be a so-called sanctuary campus. Liz, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
And Liz's story on the undocumented UW student in detention is going to air tonight on KUOW's All Things Considered. Thank you. KUOW's The Record. We're on Twitter right now, at KUOW. One night this past August, a Skagit 911 operator got a call from a family boating off of Cypress Island.
My husband and I are on our boat in Secret Harbor, and the middle fish pen is breaking apart, and we don't know who to call.
What do you mean by the middle fish pen?
So in Secret Harbor on Cypress Island, there's three fish pens. There's a bunch of equipment and stuff, like a forklift and generators and stuff, that are potentially going to go in the water. And we don't see any, like, humans around. It's huge.
That 911 caller was describing a huge cage holding tens of thousands of farmed Atlantic salmon. And the cage was breaking, spilling those fish into Puget Sound. That fish farm is run by Cook Aquaculture. Conservationist Kurt Beardsley from the Wild Fish Conservancy called the Cook Aquaculture spill total devastation.
This pen really did implode. It folded in on itself. It's completely collapsed. It's an environmental nightmare.
Is it an environmental nightmare? Now officials say all of those Atlantic salmon have disappeared. Nobody has seen one or caught one since October. Seattle Times environment reporter Linda Mapes has been reporting this story. Linda, hi.
Hi, Bill.
So here, roughly 100,000 Atlantic salmon escape in August. They're gone? Where do they go?
Huh. That's the big question, isn't it? I mean, the fact that we don't know where these fish are doesn't mean there's no harm from this incident. I think people have been too quick to jump to that conclusion. It's mixed, right? We know that these fish had no disease, no sea lice. We know from stomachs being cut open that they were not feeding on juvenile wild salmon or anything at all. These fish were starving to death. However, we also know that there hasn't been any long-term research about the effects of this. Of course, it just happened. And secondly, there hasn't even been completed sediment sampling in the area right below the fish farm pen, which was subjected to the usual detritus of food and excrement from the fish, but also effects of fish left in the pens dying as they were struggling to dealing with this mess.
So all these Atlantic salmon, they died.
They died as a pollutant.
Yeah, the fish died on their own, or were caught. They're all dead, presumably.
A little bit of everything. So the Lummi Nation caught 400,000 pounds of these fish, which were subsequently disposed of. Some non-tribal fishers also swiped up a bunch. Cook got some. Beach seining, and Cook also sucked fish with a vacuum hose out of what nets they could. But there are still 100,000 of them that are unaccounted for and presumed to be starving to death. But we don't really know that. As Jay Julius, chairman of the Lummi Nation, said to me yesterday, show me the bodies. I mean, one thing that we know about this fish salmon, this salmon escape, is that we don't know much. There's been so little science done on salmon escapes that, you know, the most recent papers are decades old. And the truest thing I've heard about this is that anyone who says they know what happens now is speaking from either ideology or emotion, because there's so little science that's been done.
And yet there's still a push to ban these Atlantic salmon farms. State lawmakers were just discussing it yesterday. What did they say?
This is interesting. Kevin Ranker, he's Democrat from Orcas Island. He says he's going to put in legislation this coming session to ban open water net pen Atlantic salmon aquaculture in Washington. He said he supports shellfish aquaculture, but there should be no invasive species aquaculture in Washington. Atlantics are an invasive species in our waters, and he wants that to end. Not immediately. The leases that exist would be allowed to run to their termination date, and after that, there would be no more, and there would be no more permits for new farms either. This is a small business in Washington still. You're talking about 8 farms, but Cook bought them 18 months ago, and they want to go big. Washington is very important to them. It's a place with the right water, the right coastline. This industry is already banned in Alaska and California. Oregon doesn't do it. Washington is the only U.S. West Coast state that does.
And what's the argument against Washington State banning them?
Against banning them?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Cook wants the business opportunity, pure and simple.
And it's just Cook lobbyists? That's it? Is there, jobs, sort of industry arguments for keeping
Not
these
very many.
Atlantic
there are
salmon farms?
80 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of revenues for the state of Washington, it's a little over $250,000 a year. It's not much.
Yeah. Now, yesterday, Linda, at this state hearing, the chair of the Lummi Nation said that Washington State's very identity might be at stake in this. Why is the state's identity at stake?
Well, you know, we're not Connecticut. We're not New Jersey. We're not Europe. We are the Northwest. And for a lot of people, tribal, non-tribal, that means a place where wild salmon is the salmon that we're talking about when we're talking about salmon. And this is an aesthetic argument. It's a cultural argument. And it's profound. And for many people, it's tied directly to their sense of place here, what Washington is and what they want it to be in the future. And to the extent that we become a place that's really all about farmed Atlantic salmon, that's a different place that people don't want to walk toward. They'd rather put the investment into supporting the wild salmon runs and the animals that depend on them, including the people.
So this Cypress Island fish spill that we began with, Linda, there's, as you said, there's so much we don't know about how fish compete against each other and the pollutants brought and disease. There's so much we don't know. So is anything about this, that big salmon spill, going to affect the debate over whether Washington State bans these Atlantic salmon farms?
I think the spill is the only reason we're having the debate. A lot of people didn't know that Atlantic net pen farming even goes on here. And, you know, Cook is despairing that their entry into the market here was so negative. They just got here 18 months ago, and they have plans to go big in Washington. But now, instead, they're fighting to even stay in operation because of what really shouldn't have happened, which was a very major fish pen escape.
So, Will, we're trying to learn what happened as a result of that fish pen escape. And as you said, we don't know that these Atlantic salmon established themselves or competed for food or ate much of anything. So I'm trying to figure out whether the good reporting you're doing on the outcome of that big fish spill, are there any results so far that might affect that argument over banning salmon farms, or is it just, hey, everything is inconclusive, and what we know about that August spill bears no relation to the debate about whether we should ban salmon farms, except that it happened. That's all we know.
The thing I'm hearing from critics is, why take the risk? You know, Puget Sound is an imperiled ecosystem. We have so many endangered and threatened species. We're spending untold millions trying to clean it up, revive it. Why add any potential threat if you don't have to? There's plenty of farmed salmon in the world, plenty of places to farm it. Why do we have to do it here? That's the major argument against it, in addition to the cultural and identity arguments. And also the argument that it's naive to assume that if we don't know today what the effects of this spill are, that means there aren't any.
Linda Mapes.
Or that there won't be. I mean, it's...
Yes.
It's also a matter of how many more escapes in the future.
Linda Mapes is following all of this for you and has been regularly letting us know on KUOW about this. She's environment reporter for the Seattle Times, talking about what we're still learning, what we know and don't know from this August spill of maybe 100,000 farmed Atlantic salmon and the debate over banning those kind of farms. Linda, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW, Seattle. So this idea of banning Atlantic salmon farms is now working its way through a legislative process, swimming upstream through legislative hearings and lobbyists and bill draftings. That is a process we know something about here in Seattle.
This is early in the process. We're hoping to have some formal recommendations come to council in May, and then we'll have deliberations starting in June in council on how we want to move forward on this. So it's great that so many folks are here today at the front end of what's going to be a long process.
Yes, a long process, also known as the Seattle process, defined years ago by the Seattle Weekly as, quote, seeking consensus through exhaustion. We wanted to know what you think of when you think of the Seattle process. Tucker tweets, even though I was 12 years old at the time, I will always think of the disastrous, aborted monorail expansion in 2005. Nothing could better symbolize the entrenched dysfunction that keeps Seattle from functioning like a big city, and why I now so enjoy living in D.C. instead. And Karis tweets, imploding the kingdom, and it wasn't paid off after 30 years. Legislation for imagined issues instead of the day-to-day issues people deal with. For everything Seattle is, nothing changes. Okay, so what if Seattle's process were more like, say, Amazon's process? Would that make the city better at dealing with issues like transportation or homelessness? Our Region of Boom team takes on that question in its latest episode of Primed. And you can find that any place you get your podcasts. Later today, Primed co-hosts Joshua McNichols and Carolyn Adolph will talk with Kim Malcolm during All Things Considered on KUOW. We are deep into the college fall quarter now, and a lot of students are thinking how nice it would be to have a home-cooked meal again. One Indian mom wants to make sure her daughter can make Indian food when she leaves for college next year, but there is a catch. Our radioactive reporter, Aliyu Musaliar, has this story.
I'm the worst cook. I'm actually worse than the worst. I'm the type of kid who burnt their cereal because I thought it'd be better to microwave Cocoa Puffs to get a more melty chocolate flavor. But next year, I'll be off to college. I'll be legally known as that weird thing, an adult, where I'll have to be cooking for myself. But my lunches still largely consist of poorly put together grilled cheese sandwiches. This inability to cook is not a family tradition. It's just me. My mom, or Umma in our native language, Malayalam, is a complete pro. For me, learning is tough. I can derive equations, and I can write thesis statements, but I can barely turn on a rice cooker.
Wait, why is there different settings for brown rice versus white rice?
Because brown rice takes longer.
Why?
I grew up with those typical South Indian staples, puttu with banana, portachi, and even a full sadhya meal. Sadhya is the go-to dish for Indian weddings and festivals. It's served on a big banana leaf instead of a plate and has dozens of small curries. It's also the dish my mom wanted to teach me. Sadhya is eaten for Onam, a festival that originated in Kerala. That's the state where my family is from in India.
It's traditionally a Hindu festival, but everybody celebrates it. It's after the rice harvest, and usually it's in September. And
that's what my mom is teaching me right now.
Look, you're messing up.
How am I doing? What?
You're messing up all over the place.
Even though Oma always has a stern face on, she seemingly glides from one task to another in the kitchen. She likes to sing the song from a particular Bollywood movie, 1942, A Love Story. I watch her whenever she's cooking. I was able to appreciate my Umma more for her ability to distinguish spices just from opening the bottle and smelling them.
I'm going to take some water from this.
What are you taking water from?
From the avial, the vegetables I cooked on. I feel like there's too much water, so I don't want to add more water.
It's the time when I need to start thinking about my life outside of our family home. Adulthood, to me, is independence. How my mom was presented adulthood was entirely different. My mom's parents weren't too wild for her to pursue a job.
As long as I had no complaints and I passed every grade, my parents were okay. They didn't really want me to excel or anything. There was nothing like that.
A lot of the time, she would push her ambition of being a doctor or engineer onto me. When she did get married, Umma was stuck. The only things she really had were her fancy sari she would wear out and her ability to cook a few traditional dishes. I'm around the age my mom had to learn to cook, But she didn't perfect those dishes for herself. She had to perfect them for a man. My mom entered an arranged marriage at a pretty young age, 21.
Basically, in an arranged marriage, your family helps you find it. There was no Tinder, or there was no, what is it called, Match.com or whatever. Yeah. The
Oma is teaching me to cook at 17 to show me that I don't need to stir the pot for anyone other than myself. A school can't teach me the flavors of my family dishes. Only Oma could do that.
Now, we do put a little jaggery in here.
What is that?
It's like brown sugar. It's like a sugar.
Oma learned from her mom too, my grandmother or Omama in Malayalam.
Omama will make the cutlet, and then I have to do the egg wash. Everybody's hands don't get dirty, and we can like a
assembly line.
Assembly line, yeah. Because we used to make like 100, 200, 300 cutlets and keep.
A year after I was born, my family decided it'd be best for my sister and I if we immigrated to America. Oma wanted her daughters to be everything she couldn't.
It's the choices. You wouldn't have had a choice to become anything. You wouldn't have had the choice to do what you want. You wouldn't have had a choice for a lot of stuff. And choices in life, you get better here.
She wanted us to study hard and not to prioritize marriage. But America is a country full of supermarkets with Wonder Bread and tomato soups. Oma didn't want us to lose touch with our heritage. For breakfast, no Fruit Loops for me. It was going to be dosa, chamundi, and sambar. But even if she could make these dishes, Oma felt like nothing tasted the same in America.
Everything tasted different. Like the chilies, the tomatoes, everything tastes different here.
But after years of learning to use what she had, she managed. Good South Indian food from Kerala is hard to get. There are a few South Indian restaurants, but the Indian restaurant scene here is dominated by people from the north. North India and South India have distinctly different cultures. So if I want to eat a good sadhya meal, I need to learn to make it by myself.
This is what?
My mom is showing me the beauty in holding the knife on my own.
Oh my god.
Even with her by my side, I was lagging.
This lime thing fell. I don't know where to put it. Okay, wait, I got it.
So we're going to cut vegetables for
avial,
which is like a dry, like all the root vegetables. What we do is we cook it down and then we put coconut.
But in the end, the girl who burnt her cocoa puffs made a pretty okay sadhya meal. I laid the dish out for my dad to try. I even looked to my mom for her final approval.
I love black eyed peas.
I'm not a bean person.
I'm a little watery.
Is it black eyed beans or peas?
Peas.
It's a peat. Black eyed peas, you know the music group. What happened to the black eyed peas guy?
Oma learned to cook because that's the skill an ideal Indian bride would have, a prerequisite. But she wants me to be as independent as possible. I'm her restart. Now what my mom really has are her nice saris, her ability to cook a few traditional dishes, and the hopes for her daughters. From Radioactive, this is Aliyah Musaliar.
You'll find more youth-produced stories on KUOW's Radioactive podcast and connect with us on Radioactive's Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. That's it for today. KUOW's The Record is put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Bond Huberman, Jason Pagano, and Jeannie Yandel. This afternoon, we'll be telling you about a range of sexual misconduct allegations against Roy Moore, Al Franken, NPR's vice president for news, and we'll talk with actress Tippi Hedren, her daughter Melanie Griffith, and her granddaughter Dakota Johnson about how being a woman in Hollywood has and has not changed over three generations. That's this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. And tomorrow at noon, it's our Week in Review. We're going to catch you up on the news you might have missed and what it all means with Erica C. Barnett, Essex Porter, and Bill Bryant. It's going to be a good show. I hope you'll join us for that tomorrow at noon. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.